And welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Glad to have you. In fact, you are our only oral argument for this afternoon. We do have six cases set for submission, but the other five are not going to be orally argued, so we will submit them for conferencing and so forth after this. You both asked for full time? Okay. Well, if you're ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Fast Investment LLC versus Prosper Bank and Tetra Tech CMI Incorporated. May it please the court, Ms. Laura Peterson Elkine will argue for the appellant. Mr. Jack Masco will argue for the appellate.
Okay. Ms. Elkine, would you like to start?
Yes.
Come forward.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Claims that are disposed of at summary judgment are not necessarily groundless for purposes of Rule 13 sanctions. That a party chooses to maintain those claims and fight a motion for summary judgment is not evidence of bad faith. 101,636.17 is an inappropriate and unjust punishment for a small family-owned car wash whose attorneys decided what claims to bring and whether the economic loss rule barred them. These are some but not all of the ways in which the trial court abused its discretion in entering the sanctions order against Fast Investments, and why the judgment based on the sanctions order should be reversed. This case presents an opportunity for the court to distinguish the standards for summary judgment from the standards for Rule 13 sanctions. It presents an opportunity to address the extent to which clients should be responsible for the actions of their lawyers and the sanctity of Rule 11 agreements between counsel. And most importantly, it presents an opportunity to undo an obviously harsh, arbitrary, and unjust sanction imposed on a family-owned car wash. The trial court abused its discretion in imposing sanctions if it based the order on an erroneous view of the law or on a clearly erroneous assessment of the evidence. The trial court did this in a number of ways. First, we know that the trial court equated Tetra Tech's success on summary judgment with groundlessness for purposes of Rule 13. We know that the trial court applied a summary judgment standard in determining whether Fast Investments' tort claims were groundless when filed. The trial court stated this on the record at the hearing on the motion for sanctions. The trial court stated this on the record at the hearing on Prosper's motion for judgment. The sanctions order does not explain how Fast Tort's claims were groundless, so we have no indication that the trial court applied any test other than a summary judgment test in determining groundlessness for purposes of Rule 13. This was an abuse of discretion. I've also cited case law to the court. The Schwager case out of Houston says you can't get sanctions just because you won and the other party lost. You also can't get your attorney's fees for defending against a plaintiff's claim. Yet this is exactly what happened. Tetra Tech got its attorney's fees in defending Fast Investments' claims, and it got its attorney's fees as a sanction just because it prevailed on its motion for summary judgment. Even though the trial court determined that Tetra Tech was entitled to summary judgment, Fast Tort claims were not groundless for purposes of Rule 13. They, in fact, had merit, and they were supported by the facts and the law. The tort claims of fraud and negligent misrepresentation were supported by a misrepresentation that was in not only the summary judgment record, but also in the response to Tetra Tech's motion for sanctions. In that record was a draw request inspection report that had been completed by Tetra Tech that misrepresented the percentage completion of the construction of the car wash. So there was, in fact, evidence of misrepresentations in the record, even though the FAST representatives stated in their depositions that they knew of none.
Who prepared that report?
That was a Tetra Tech report. It was Tetra Tech's inspectors that prepared it.
Okay.
What was Tetra Tech's job?
Tetra Tech's job was to, they worked with the owner of the property as well as the bank, and they would inspect the property to approve a payment. And
there was a three-way contract.
Yes.
And the three-way contract for Tetra Tech was that they were Prosper Bank's agent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then after that, they were working with Fast Investments and Hughes, and their job was to look at the status of the job and then to opine on requests for draws.
Yes, they would approve a draw based on how far along the project had come. Yes, Your Honor.
And they weren't responsible for looking at the architectural aspects of completion and looking at what was actually done in terms of the work itself in compliance with plans or specifications. They weren't responsible for looking at how much money was being paid by the contractor to the subcontractors. None of that was their job.
Well, I'm not sure about the money paid to the subcontractors, but they weren't responsible for the quality of the work. They just looked at the percent completion and then gave a report.
And in terms of the issue about there being a, what you said, a misrepresentation about the percentage of work completed was a misrepresentation in the record. Didn't I hear you say that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who benefited from that misrepresentation?
Well,
it's your client, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor, because my client paid money to the contractor for work that he had not done based on that misrepresentation.
And was the misrepresentation made to your client or was it made to the bank?
It was made to both of them, actually.
And in terms of the pleadings, my concern about your position in the case, first off, I note that you were not trial counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Nathan Chapman was trial counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there a claim made against Nathan Chapman for any activity that he took or didn't take in this case by your client?
No, there has not been, Your Honor. There has not been.
And in terms of the issues involved with the summary judgment matter, you're talking about the court improperly awarded a summary judgment or awarded to Tetra Tech the $101,000 based upon sanctions requested by Tetra Tech, and that ultimately was assigned to the bank, and the bank should never have gotten that and shouldn't have been able to collect it and shouldn't have got a judgment.
Yes, sir.
Now, in terms of the timing, I understand that the first original petition in this case was filed, looking at the record, on February the 23rd of 2009.
I believe so.
The first amended petition was filed on May the 11th of 2009. And then the summary judgment motion was by Tetra Tech was filed on June the 9th of 2010 with a response on August the 9th of 2010. And at the same time as the response to the motion for summary judgment was filed, the second amended petition was filed, and that's the one that all of this stems from in terms of
yes.
All right, and my concern is that when I read the record and I look at the response that was filed to the summary judgment, language that's in the response itself acknowledges that there were no representations ever made by Tetra Tech to the plaintiff.
The response acknowledges that. Well, I will say that I would have handled this case a lot differently in the trial court, and I do believe that there were misrepresentations made, and just because your client says in a deposition that there weren't any, perhaps the client wasn't prepared and the client was thinking of oral statements. But as a lawyer looking at this case, I deem that report to have been a representation of the percent completion of the project, and it was inaccurate.
Let me tell you, I want you to hone in on what I'm asking you, please, ma'am. I'm looking at page 78 in the pleading that was filed by Fast Tech LLC. And the first paragraph of Roman numeral four, the sentence says Tetra Tech's CMI is correct, that it made no direct misrepresentations to plaintiff. However, the evidence shows that Prosper Bank did. So the focus in this summary judgment proceeding was, right, Tetra Tech didn't make any representations or misrepresentations, rather the bank did. Well, I don't see that with that position on the summary judgment that there's any question about what happened as between Tetra Tech and Fast, based on there being no conversations and no misrepresentations, and the concern I have is that the pleading, that is the second amended petition, was filed on the same day as this response that has this language in it, which clearly indicates that the parties, Fast, understood, had to understand, through its attorney, that it was taking a position in a summary judgment response and that was reiterating claims that of tort claims against Tetra Tech at the very same time on the very same day.
Your Honor, so you're saying you see the inconsistency between reasserting those claims and admitting there were no misrepresentations.
When you file a pleading that has no basis in fact and no basis for the assertion of the claim and no attempt at extending the law, to me that's the case law that puts a big circle around your argument. Okay. In terms of your presentation on appeal,
can I please address that?
Yes, ma'am.
Because if we're talking about the filing of the second amended petition being the sanctionable conduct, you're saying that is the problem. You filed this response to motion for summary judgment. You're reasserting your claims. That's bad faith. As I understand, that's what you're saying.
No, I'm saying it's bad faith from the start. The language is in the first original petition, the first amended petition, and the second amended petition. It's in the live pleading that was before the court whenever all this was being considered and ruled on by the trial court.
But I still disagree that I think this case was mishandled. I think this case was mishandled. And I do think that there were fraud and negligence misrepresentation claims. I do believe.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
For a second? As I understand it, the money that was paid out based upon that report was loan funds that Fast had obtained that were being held by Tetra Tech.
Yes.
And once that report was filed, the loan money for that percentage of completion was then paid out, so they were indebted for that amount, right?
Indebted, and the money went to the contractor, and he hadn't done the work. And Fast was ultimately sued by a subcontractor who had not been paid. So they had been wronged. There was, they did pay the contractor for work he did not do, which they claim was in reliance on a report, which
Was there any evidence they relied on the report, or did they have a say-so in whether the money was paid out once the inspection report was issued by Tetra Tech?
There was a dispute about that, and essentially if the report supported it, the bank and Tetra Tech encouraged them to make the payment. There was actually evidence that they didn't want to make the payment, and they said, wait, this work hasn't been done. They made the payment anyway in reliance that they needed to do it. So,
okay, and your position on these pleadings would be, or and is in your brief, that it was the legal theories that the attorneys asserted and not the factual basis for it that constituted the reason for the trial court's sanctions.
I think the attorneys decided whether those facts gave rise to fraud and negligent misrepresentation and breach of contract. Subsequently, they asserted a gross negligence claim. The lawyers decided to do that, and the lawyers, you can't credit Fast Investments with knowledge of the economic loss rule. I mean, that was a big reason for the court's ruling on the motion for summary judgment was the economic loss rule, and that was an incorrect ruling. Fraud is not barred by the economic loss rule. The Formosa Plastics case has been on the books for a long, long time. Negligent misrepresentation is not barred by the economic loss rule for out-of-pocket damages. And that was a big, if you look at the record, the court relied on that economic loss rule more so than on the issue of the representations. That was the big issue for him, was the economic loss rule. And the problem I have, too, is just because a party gets a summary judgment doesn't mean the analysis has been performed that the claims were groundless for purposes of Rule 13, and the court did not do that. And he clearly said, you win summary judgment, okay, those claims were groundless for purposes of Rule 13. And I do not think those can be equated. And I think that was he did not follow the law about Rule 13 sanctions. He did not. And he made it very clear. He said, summary judgment, that means your case is crud, it's frivolous. If you got a summary judgment against you, your case is crud. Well, that's not the case. That's not right, and we all know that you can have a decent case and lose. You can have a decent case and lose at summary judgment, but that doesn't mean your case was in violation of Rule 13 and it was groundless and filed in bad faith.
One of the guidelines, as I understand it, for sanctioning the client as opposed to the attorney would be if the client, if there was evidence produced that the client participated in the filing of something, a pleading and so forth, that was groundless. The clients, as I understand it, were not even there at the hearing. Were they given notice that sanctions were going to be sought at that hearing against the clients?
They were had noticed that. I think they were asked not to be there. I understand that they were asked not to be there, and they were not put on the stand. In the meantime, while all of this was happening, the lawyer for Prosper and the lawyer for Fast Investments entered into a settlement agreement, a walk-away settlement agreement. So that happened as well, and they thought that was the last they'd ever see of Prosper in the lawsuit, and here they come back months later trying to get a judgment on the sanction amount that Tetra Tech got. So that is very disturbing as well, and I think that that Rule 11 agreement was on the record, and I think clearly it was a mutual walk away. I think all the claims, any claims that would arise from that lawsuit, were covered by that Rule 11 agreement.
I see the light has gone off, so I believe you're out of time. I didn't notice how much over she went 4 minutes, so we'll grant the appellee 4 extra minutes here. I'm sorry.
And thank you.
Have rebuttal after his presentation.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jad Masso. I'm with Strasburger and Price, and I represent Prosper Bank. I think we've all had decent cases that we lost. This is not a situation where there was a decent case that the plaintiffs lost, and as a result, they're being sanctioned. This is a sanctions case because it was a frivolous case that was deemed frivolous, was deemed groundless, and brought in bad faith, and so they were sanctioned. That's what makes this case different from the standard summary judgment case. Before I get into responding to the details of everything Mrs. Elkind said, I want to talk for a second about the standard of review, because although we all agree that this is being reviewed under an abuse of discretion, there are a couple of aspects of that standard that come into play in reviewing sanctions that are important. And these have been mentioned numerous times in this court by members of this panel, Smith versus Duncan Land and Exploration, and In Re SAM a few years ago. I'm sure you're all familiar with those. But the standard in reviewing a sanctions order is to determine whether there was some evidence that would have supported the trial court's conclusion. And in the alternative, some evidence or conflicting evidence. Only if there is no evidence at all is a sanctions order an abuse of discretion and should be reversed. So that's what we are looking for today, to see if there is some evidence that would support this decision. We might all have done it differently. I think that's always the case. We may, in hindsight, so it's always 20/20, but if there's some evidence to support what the trial court did, then we need to uphold that and leave it be.
Okay, and so that means Tetra Tech had the burden of proof.
That's right.
Okay.
And obviously this is a little unusual in that I am not representing Tetra Tech. We are the assignee of that judgment. So, but we are standing in their place defending that order. Ms. Elkind talked a lot about groundlessness and what's different, and that the court needs to distinguish the standard for groundlessness from the standard for summary judgment. Well, this court has already done that. The standard for sanctions is much higher. It requires that there have been a reasonable inquiry before a pleading be filed to understand whether the facts are worthwhile. And there's also the question of whether a party was on notice that its claims were without merit before the pleading was filed. Both of those occurred in this case. Both of those standards were met in this case to warrant an award of sanctions. And again, we're just looking for some evidence. I think we've got more than just some. Ms. Elkind said a couple of times as she was beginning that we know that the trial court did not follow the groundlessness standard. And they say this because they're looking at the transcript and they don't see that standard recited anywhere. The fact that it's not recited on the record doesn't mean that it wasn't followed, and it doesn't mean that the standard isn't met when the court's reviewing the entire record here. Certainly it was. The trial court went as far in the order awarding sanctions to list out the factual bases under which it found these claims to be groundless. It stated in particular that there was no reasonable inquiry before the second amended petition was filed, and that the facts underlying the tort claims were simply incorrect.
What evidence of no reasonable notice was there? No reasonable inquiry.
The order doesn't go into detail about why there was no reasonable inquiry. I think what it does, though, is it ties in with the fact that they were on notice of the merits of their claims before the pleading was filed.
The question is, what evidence was presented at the sanctions hearing that there was no reasonable inquiry?
The evidence that was given at the sanctions hearing was the record of the case. There was no live testimony.
It was argument of counsel.
It was argument and a review of the filings in the case. Things like the depositions of the parties, but there are three individuals that represented Fast Investments. Each of them had testified, for example, before the pleading was filed, that there had been no representations, no fraud, things of that nature. And then, of course, subsequent to that, the filing of the response to the MSJ, which Justice Meyer questioned Ms. Elkind about a little bit, and then simultaneously, of course, this amended petition that's restating those same claims again, even though they themselves have testified that there's no facts to support them, and as well, our motion for summary judgment, rather Tetra Tech's motion for summary judgment, has put them on notice that based on your testimony, these claims fail, and based on the economic loss rule, and I hear Mrs. Elkind to say it's difficult, the economic loss rule is difficult enough for us to understand, let alone for a layperson. But when you're coming right out and saying, as they do in their pleadings, that all of this stems from the contract, all of these claims stem from the contract, it makes it very difficult to support a tort claim, and that's all we're talking about here. They weren't sanctioned for their contract claim. They were sanctioned for bringing tort claims on top of their contract claims, and that's why they were groundless.
Well, extra contractual claims, contort claims, whatever you want to call them, that, in, as you said about the economic loss rule, is a difficult area and has always been.
It is, and I'm going to differ with, I'm sorry, was Your Honor finished?
No, I'm there.
I want to differ just for a moment with Mrs. Elkheim. She said that the trial court relied heavily, heavily, heavily on the economic loss rule. If you look at the sanctions order, the economic loss rule isn't mentioned. What's mentioned in there time and time again is the deposition testimony where they gave their claims away. What's mentioned in there is false testimony, misleading testimony. The history of the case leading up, heavy on the involvement of the plaintiffs, not on the legal theory. I think, you know, this court has got to go back and look at the entire record, and I think looking back at the entire record, you can see that the economic loss rule probably does knock out their negligence claim, probably their gross negligence claim. There may be an argument to knock out fraud, but I don't think that's critical. I think it's part of the piece, and it's part of what influenced the court to say this is sanctionable activity, and it warrants a significant sanction.
But why against the parties and not against the lawyers, other than that he liked the tie of Nathan Chadman?
Well,
I'm
he did like the tie. No, that tripped me for a moment, then I remember, no, there was that whole discourse in there. You know, what this case gives us, and it's similar to a couple of other cases that we cited in the briefs, this case involves action by the parties in support of their claims. The cases where you've seen sanctions overturned against a party, it's something where the lawyer was completely on his own, a motion for extension of time, a misrepresentation about a trial setting, something like that. If you look at the cases we cite, in particular Monroe versus Grider, that's a Dallas case from 94. Wish it were Fort Worth, but I figure Dallas is at least just down the road. That's one where the party, there was an amended petition that was filed. Prior to the filing of the amended petition, there was very damaging deposition testimony from the party that essentially that destroyed their claims. They filed the amended petition anyway, and the Court of Appeals upheld the sanction against the party, saying, look, you put your neck out there trying to support these claims. The claims obviously fail. You knew that, and then you filed an amended petition. That's enough involvement of the party to show that the party was in the loop. It wasn't just the lawyer hearing the plaintiff's story and then going off on this course of action all alone. There was another case out of the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston just from last year called Nath versus Texas Children's. That one was a little bit even more narrow and certainly fits the facts of this case. In that case, the plaintiff filed an affidavit in support of its claims, which we have several affidavits here that were filed in connection with the response to the MSJ trying to support these tort claims. But again, at most what they do is they confuse the issues, and they're trying to contradict their deposition testimony, and it just doesn't get them off the ground.
I've read that opinion in preparation for these oral arguments, and I think there's a vast difference. Dr. Nast, apparently, or at least according to the findings of fact and conclusions of law, had studied law. Hmm. He drove the case according to the court's findings. He insisted on these depositions that were apparently, according to the appellate court, totally irrelevant to the merits of the case. His case as plaintiff, and ran up $400,000 or $500,000 in fees. Mm. Primarily, I mean, that's my understanding. I'm not saying that's true or
that
not, but
certainly sounds more egregious than this.
I find that very egregious, since he was apparently controlling the case, and one of his lawyers happened to have been Mr. Flowers, who was Tetra Tech's lawyer. Just ran across that by accident, so I guess Flowers acquired a great deal of research and knowledge about these issues in the course of trying to defend Dr. Nash.
Certainly Nath, and I don't remember all the
it's
details.
It's Nash or Nath.
I think it's whichever it is, the good doctor probably overstepped more so than Fast did here, but still sanctionable for similar reasons, in that you saw the hand of the client, the hand of the party involved in the actions the lawyer was taking. And in this case, as in Monroe, you saw deposition testimony or affidavits, whichever it might be, supporting the claims that have already been shown to be false. That shows some complicity, and I think it certainly gets us to that some evidence threshold that gets us to a point where we should not disturb the trial court's opinion of the matter as it was at the time.
Mr. Massa, you mentioned in passing the filing of affidavits with the response to the motion for summary judgment that was filed on August the 9th of 2010. That's the same date as the filing of the second amended petition, which was again alleging the tort claims. And that in spite of the contentions of the Tetra Tech filings in their motion for summary judgment and their affidavits and their evidence on deposition. And therefore, if I'm understanding the record right, and I read this earlier this morning again, and that was that the motion for the response to the motion for summary judgment of FAST included an affidavit of, I think the lady's name was Wiggins.
I believe
it was an additional affidavit of Ms. Wiggins, which once again recited facts dealing with the claims for the tort claims that had already been addressed and refuted and acknowledged by pleadings filed by her own attorney, that they simply didn't exist.
It's very concerning, and it certainly shows, again, the hand of the plaintiff in these claims. And it shows that the plaintiff, unlike some other cases that you see where the lawyer is exclusively culpable, it certainly shows that the plaintiff does have a hand in this and does share some responsibility. Would sanctions have been appropriate against the attorney in this case? Possibly so. There wasn't a motion for sanctions against the attorney. That wasn't considered. Would it have been within the bounds of the court's discretion? It would seem to appear so, just based on all the cases I've read preparing for this one. But what it does not do is show that the sanction against the party in this case was inappropriate. I think we're still within the bounds of discretion.
And we have, as a part of our record, statements that were made at the time of the hearing on the motion for summary judgment and for sanctions, whereby the trial court was advising the parties in the courtroom that the trial court was not looking at a claim for inappropriate action by the attorney alone. And I didn't find that those statements were directly challenged in any of the written pleadings filed after the date of the hearing.
No, it certainly appears from the record that everyone was on the same page, that we were just talking about the actions of the parties, not the actions of the attorneys.
All right, thank you, sir.
I have a question about the amount of attorney's fees awarded as sanctions. It's my understanding, and from Mr. Flowers' affidavit, that he incurred $142,000 in attorney's fees defending the suit. And then his affidavit says that 101 and some odd change of that was spent defending the frivolous claims, the groundless claims. Is that correct?
That is right. And that gets us to a very interesting point, one that I feel like we've seen a lot of cases out of our courts and the Texas Supreme Court in recent years about proof of amount of attorney's fees. And what's interesting, we were talking a minute ago about the standard under sanctions, standard for awarding sanctions versus the standard for summary judgment. It was interesting to me to see the contrast here between the standards for the amount of award of the sanctions as compared to the standard for proof of attorney's fees. And it's much looser. There's concern, I know, from FAST that the $101,000 might not be reasonable or necessary just for those tort claims, that it should really be, maybe it should be the 40 instead of the 100, it should be flipped or something like that. But the discretion, the deferential basis that we have for the trial court in a sanctions context is much broader. For one thing, there's no requirement that reasonableness and necessity be proven. The costs and fees are, the term you see a lot is monetary guidepost. It's sort of seen as a starting place that can be increased or decreased. But there are other factors that the trial court can take into consideration in determining what's an appropriate number. And so it well could have been that $35,000 was the necessary fee to defend these claims, and it may have still been appropriate to award a $100,000 sanction once you take into account the history of the case, the discovery abuse that we also outline in our motion and that the trial court outlined in the order. There were a lot of findings dealing with discovery abuse, impact on the judicial system.
But I think that you're confusing. I think that under Rule 13, the trial court can award an appropriate sanction under Rule 215, and Rule 215 point two, let's see where I am, B8 does require a showing of reasonable expenses, including attorney's fees, caused by the failure. So if we're pulling Rule 13 through, I think there is a requirement that attorney's fees have to be reasonable. If we're doing a discovery sanction, that's a whole different animal versus a groundless Rule 13 finding. I think those are two separate standards. And honestly, my concern is that if these pleadings, these theories are groundless, so they have no basis in law and no basis in fact, that means straight up, no way, no how, nothing in the law supports them, nothing in the facts support them, how can two-thirds of the attorney's fees required in the case be spent on those claims?
I think it may well be the case that they cannot. I think if we were getting into a dispute under the standard, under L. Apple or some higher standard for defining reasonable fees under segregation of fees, I'd be in a lot hotter water than I am. But under N. Ray SAM, which is this court's opinion from a few years ago, and some of the other jurisprudence on the amount of fees awardable as sanctions, there is not a requirement of reasonableness and necessity. And I'm trying to remember the rule, and I don't have it in front of me. It may be that further down in 215.2, there's some looser language that says and something else, but for what are that can be adjusted or there can be additional things. But the cases have interpreted that, for better or for worse, to mean that there is not a reasonableness and necessity requirement, that it can be flexible. In fact, the Houston Court of Appeals just a few years ago awarded three times the amount of fees as a sanction in one case because they found it so egregious.
As a Rule 13 sanction?
As a Rule 13 sanction.
And which case is that?
Falk and Mayfield versus someone, I'm not Miser or Miter or something like that. It's from the 14th Court in 1998. It's in our brief. That was the only case I found, to be quite candid, where there was a significant amount more awarded. But there have been cases where there's more awarded. And this court has talked about that the reasonableness necessity is not really a standard here because it's a discretionary award. There's a lot more play in it. And because of that, the Texas Supreme Court has adopted the ABA factors for sanctions, which allow you to take into account more things than just the monetary impact on the opposing party. You can consider the effect on the judicial system. You can do it as a punishment or as a deterrent to others. There's other factors that can come into play that I think the trial court considered here and said, you know, even if I'm not convinced that $101,000 was what it took, it might have taken only 70 or 80. That's giving me that monetary guidepost to know the impact of this, and I don't like it, and I'm upset about it, and I've got discretion here to award more or to award less. And I'm going to go with that $101,000 that's been proposed. I think that's what's happened, and I think that's within the court's discretion.
What evidence was there from any source that the fees were unreasonable in terms of the evidence that's before the court?
Ms. Elkind may correct me, but I don't believe there was any.
Well, she made an affidavit, if I'm understanding it correctly, and that the affidavit was stricken.
That's my recall as well. I don't think there was anything other than that affidavit which was stricken.
All right, thank you.
I do want to address just briefly, this came up at the very end, is the question of the settlement, and I don't know how much concern this is for your honors, but Prosper Bank and FAST did settle their dispute with one another at the same time that the sanctions order was heard. That was back in May of 2011. There was, for lack of a better term, a mutual walkaway. It was stated on the record. It's in the transcript. It was not until December of 2011 that Tetra Tech's sanctions award, this award, was transferred to the bank. That's why we're here. Certainly we didn't prospectively settle future disputes we might have, future claims. We still do business with FAST. I'm sure the bank would be very concerned if the allegation were that we waived everything we could ever have against them, because certainly they owe us money still. We haven't given that up. We didn't give it up prospectively in May, and we haven't released it since. Thank you, Your Honors.
Did you add the 4 minutes? Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll hear from Ms. Elkind on rebuttal.
And you'll ask me more questions and I'll get more time. First of all, the groundlessness. There's no groundlessness is not an evidentiary issue. It's a question of law. So there's not some evidence of groundlessness. And it was either a correct legal ruling or it wasn't. The claims were either had a basis in law and fact or they didn't. And that's where we get this economic loss rule issue. That was a question of law. That was wrong. The court incorrectly decided that. And the cases that there are a lot of cases that the Monroe v. Greider case that Mr. Massa was talking about, that was a clear question of law. Is it someone, is it negligent entrustment to let a 16-year-old drive a golf cart? There are laws that there are legal decisions that say that alone is not evidence of negligent entrustment. That alone cannot be, just the age cannot be something that you take into account. It was a question of law. So anyway, we have the groundlessness issue. The bad faith is an evidentiary issue. And Tetra Tech had the burden of showing bad faith on the part of Fast Investments. And there was a presumption in favor of Fast Investments, a presumption in favor that of those claims being filed in good faith. And I don't think that presumption was overcome. Judge Meyer, you had a question about the inconsistency between the motion for summary judgment and the affidavits, and that Mrs. Wiggins' affidavit claimed misrepresentations, and the attorney's motion said there were no representations. Whose fault is that? I think that's the lawyer's fault. He didn't coordinate the case. He didn't present it well. He had a decent case. He didn't do a good job with it.
Well, let me ask you if you think that the attorney for Fast admitted himself out of court with the following language that's on page 540 of the Fast Investment LLC's motion for reconsideration of defendant Tetra Tech's motion for sanctions and recovery of costs. Okay? Last pleading. Though poorly pleaded, if pleaded at all, the fraud, negligent misrepresentation, and gross negligence claims asserted against Tetra Tech in the original petition and the second amended petition all are based on the same facts as the breach of contract claim for which the court declined to impose sanctions. Now, if all of those theories of recovery, tort theories, are based on the same facts as the claim for breach of contract, that's a matter of law that the claims for tort were improper, groundless, and asserted at a time whenever the clients were bound by the attorney in the document that he filed with the court. I don't understand how you ever get around that, Ms. Eklund.
The fact that you're saying that the tort claims were barred because they were based on the contract.
As a matter of law.
Well, I disagree with you because I think the economic loss rule. I just had a case 2 years ago based on Formosa Plastics, and it was a fraud case, and there was a contract, and I think you can have a fraud claim when there is a contract.
Yes, maybe I missed that in the briefing. If you put that in your briefing,
the Sherryland case recently came out from the Texas Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court says, you know, this is a very complicated area of the law.
What I'm asking you is not your interpretation of the law, and might differ with my interpretation of the law, but really, where was there any refuting of this position taken in the pleadings filed with the court on the part of Fast that these admissions didn't bar them from their relief that you now seek in our court?
The pleadings based on the economic loss rule?
Based on the theory that the facts or the fraud, negligent misrepresentation, and gross negligence are the same facts as the breach of contract claim.
Well, I agree that argument was made. I agree. And that was another reason why goes into the attorney fee issue, that they were all the same facts, doesn't justify three-fourths of the fees being awarded to Tetra Tech when the breach of contract claim was not held by the court to have been in violation of Rule 13.
Thank you for answering my questions, ma'am.
Yes, your time is up, counsel. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefing, which is very helpful. We will adjourn court, and you are, wait, your case is submitted, and you are excused. Thank you very much.